fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky podcast. I'm Jasmine Smith, and Robert Connie is enjoying another week of paternity leave this week. But we're going to be talking about COVID and the protests, and we'll be continuing my three-week law series. So last week we talked some criminal law and also about appellate courts, and today we are going to be talking some bankruptcy law with Allie Holt. And Allie is an attorney for Wasson and Thornhill in Louisville, Kentucky. She grew up in Greenup County and went on to graduate from Morehead State and University of Kentucky College of Law. We went to law school around the same time, and so that's how we know each other. She's also clerked for a Kentucky Supreme Court Justice, and she worked as a public defender before going into bankruptcy law. But for the last several years, she's been helping clients through Chapter 7 and 13 bankruptcies. So, Allie, welcome to my Old Kentucky podcast for the first time.
Hi, Jasmine. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so bankruptcy law is not something we've really talked about a lot on the podcast. We've talked about it in the context of coal company bankruptcies. So I want to kind of go back to the basics. Can you just talk about the basic types of bankruptcies that we hear about the most often, which are Chapter 7, 11, and 13?
Sure. So a Chapter 7 is probably what most people think of when they think of bankruptcy as far as layman's terms. A Chapter 7 is what's referred to as a total bankruptcy. So individuals and businesses can file Chapter 7s. Personal bankruptcies are most common in Chapter 7. So when someone files a Chapter 7, they have to qualify under the current laws in terms of what their income is for their household size. They also want to make sure that all of their assets are going to be protected. But basically, it's about a three-month process upon filing that will discharge most all debts and allow the client to move forward with a fresh start. So that's different from a Chapter 13, which is just a personal bankruptcy, where if you don't qualify for a Chapter 7, let's say because your income is too high, or let's say you have too much equity in your home, you may opt to file a Chapter 13, wherein you'd be put in a personal reorganization of some kind. So you would be given a 3 to 5 year plan where you would make a monthly payment on your debts to the bankruptcy trustee and then receive a discharge of any debts that have not been repaid at the end of that plan. So a Chapter 11 is mostly just business reorganization. So it's very similar to a Chapter 13, except for it's mostly businesses filing for reorganization.
Yeah, I think it's really important to talk about the difference between Chapter 7 and 13 bankruptcies, because you get a lot of people coming in wanting to file and they all think they can do this Chapter 7 where they get rid of all their debt. Mm-hmm. But then they find out that because they paid so much on their house, you know, they're probably not eligible for it. So it can be a tough awakening for a lot of people that need that relief.
Absolutely.
So we've talked about on the podcast before about Kentucky court structures. So we've talked about district courts and circuit courts on local levels, and also about some federal courts. And last week we talked about appellate state courts. But how do bankruptcy courts fit into that structure? Because they're a little different, right?
Yeah. So bankruptcy is all federal in terms of the court structure. So the bankruptcy court is a specialty court that's a subset of the federal district court. So that's sort of how it fits in.
So the way that we've talked about bankruptcy here on the podcast is, like I said before, with coal company bankruptcies. So even though it's federal law, we've been hearing about a lot of Kentucky businesses filing Chapter 11 bankruptcies in the last couple of years, including coal companies, Two Keys Tavern in Lexington recently filed mm-hmm. bankruptcy, and Gincana, which is a very large CBD product producer. And I think a lot of people think that bankruptcy for a business means it's done, but what could a Chapter 11 mean for these companies, and what could be done in a Chapter 11, you know, to keep them afloat?
Yeah, so a lot of the time in Chapter 11s, businesses stay open as usual. They continue conducting business, and similar to a Chapter 13, they're proposing a plan to the bankruptcy court judge and to their creditors about how they would proceed, how they would pay off some of these debts, which debts would get repaid in full, things that they're going to do to cut back expenses, things that they're going to do to bring in more income. So most of the time, probably, I would say, even though I don't generally file Chapter 11s, most of the time businesses stay open, although there are those cases where, you know, maybe there's not a reorganization that really works. Mm-hmm. So the business ends up liquidating assets through a Chapter 11 and shutting their doors.
Yeah. And I think, like, with all of these coal company bankruptcies, you've seen kind of a mix of the two, some that are able to keep operating and then some that have ended up completely liquidating. But it's important to know that, you know, some companies can absolutely come back from bankruptcy and, mm-hmm. you know, still thrive later on. But, you know, we can't really do a lot about bankruptcy laws in Kentucky because they're federal. But, you know, we talk on here a lot about criminal legal reforms and changes that we want to see. So what are some of the reforms or changes in bankruptcy law that you'd like to see?
Well, number one would be student loan debt reform.
Yeah, I thought that might be it.
Within the bankruptcy context. So I talk to clients about this. There are a lot of people who think that student loans are non-dischargeable through bankruptcy. They are, like, under all circumstances. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily true. But the current laws are so restrictive on who can qualify to get student loans discharged that it essentially is that way in a lot of cases. Not to mention the people who need it the most have the least amount of money to pay an attorney. So, and, you know, attorneys can only take on so many pro bono cases of this type when there's so many people out there who need this help. So reform, you know, Elizabeth Warren talked a lot about that in her presidential run. And there was a bill that she co-sponsored in 2019 that talked about bankruptcy reform and specifically making student loans no longer non-dischargeable. That, I think, is number one, because I see people all the time, my age and older and younger. It really affects everyone, but specifically, I think millennials are in the throes of it right now, where student loans are just, you know, crushing people.
Yeah, the standard to get your student loans discharged is nearly impossible, but, like, it does exist. You know, there has to be some kind of hardship shown. And Allie once told me a rumor that a bankruptcy attorney in town got his own student loans discharged.
Yeah.
So I'd love to know how that happened.
Yeah. I would have loved to have been there in the courtroom. But another problem is that, you know, the whole undue hardship thing, they don't specifically define that. So mm-hmm. there's some case law out there that it's called a Bruner test, but not all courts use that test. And some courts, you know, distinguish it differently than others. So, and, you know, with bankruptcy, you also don't know what judge you're going to get when you file. So all of that can impact the really, really restrictive standard that you have to meet.
Yeah, that's something that I talk a lot about when it comes to, like, bail and other criminal issues, that things can vary so wildly based on the judge you get. And mm-hmm. bankruptcy court is really no different.
Yeah.
So switching gears a little bit. So COVID-19 has affected court operations in a lot of ways. A lot of civil trials are on hold. And then, you know, we talked about issues last week in criminal cases with getting a fair jury pool, confrontation of witnesses, speedy trial rights, and not to mention that clients are incarcerated in places that have seen major coronavirus outbreaks. How have bankruptcy cases and court proceedings been affected by the pandemic?
Yeah, so a lot of people think that the bankruptcy court is closed. They'll call me and want to talk about what they can do, but they'll say, you know, I know court's not open right now. That's not the case. And I have to applaud the bankruptcy court, because I think they've done a great job of handling this. Since pretty early on, all of the bankruptcy court hearings, 341 meetings, all of your hearings in front of the judges have been conducted telephonically, and some of them through Zoom hearings. So we're still business as usual. In personal bankruptcies, there's not a ton of, especially in the Western District of Kentucky, which covers Louisville, mm-hmm. There's not a ton of evidentiary hearings. So I haven't had an evidentiary hearing since COVID started, and I'm not sure exactly how they're handling those, although I would bet it's through Zoom. But all of my hearings have been telephonic, and it's worked out better for a lot of my clients, honestly, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, sometimes transportation to the courthouse downtown mm-hmm. is really tough for clients. They're already struggling. They're giving up their cars and their bankruptcies sometimes. So I could see how this might actually be helpful for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So I'm also wondering, Mitch McConnell has been in the news over the last few months for saying that, you know, states didn't necessarily need federal relief because they can just file bankruptcy. What are some of the issues, you know, you see if Kentucky has to file bankruptcy because we can't get any relief from the federal government during the pandemic?
That's a good question. So I'm not sure I know how to answer that. Let me think. So if Kentucky had to file bankruptcy, you know, I don't know what chapter that would be under, to be honest, because it's not a personal entity. So it can't file a Chapter 13. It's not a business. It's a state. So, you know, I'm not sure how that would work, to be honest. Do you have any idea? What are your ideas? Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know what he honestly means by that. And, you know, how are we going to liquidate assets? How, who is it that's filing bankruptcy? Would it be literally Commonwealth, in re Commonwealth of Kentucky? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it would be.
Yeah.
And I don't know how it'd work out. I really don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't think we know what would happen. So hopefully, you know, the federal government will come through with another relief package so that we don't have to be in that situation. So, you know, this is a non-bankruptcy related question. You have also volunteered to represent protesters mm-hmm. pro bono in their criminal cases because you have been a criminal defense attorney.
Yeah.
So what has that process been like so far?
So I have to applaud, you know, Ted Shouse, the Kentucky Bail Project, Courtney Kellner. They have, you know, gotten a large, diverse group of local attorneys, you know, together and willing to take on these protesters' criminal cases. It's nice to go back and do some criminal stuff. I don't mm-hmm. get to do that very often. Right now, I have about 3 open files, and, you know, they email me another one whenever my name pops up on the list. I actually haven't had any court dates yet. All of my cases are pretty minor misdemeanor charges. So they were, you know, ROR'd, released on their own recognizance at their arraignment, or, you know, prior to arraignment, and then their pretrial conferences were set out for a pretty significant amount of time since it wasn't a pressing charge with them still being incarcerated. So I had 2 court dates that were in August. Both of those got pushed and are being rescheduled to a later date. I have one coming up in September, and as far as I know, it's still on for a pretrial conference, but I've been talking with those clients over the phone, you know, about their situations and just sort of waiting to see what the county attorney's office is going to do on this, what their position is going to be.
Yeah, I think that pushing court dates is something we haven't talked about a lot in the context of what's going on in criminal courts right now. We've been talking about, you know, incarcerated clients that are at high risk for the virus, but people that are out of custody with misdemeanor charges, they can be affected too, because you and I have had clients a million times where they're trying to get a job, but they're, you know, they have a background check or they can't have any pending charges open. That's usually an issue, having pending charges.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, hopefully employers don't look down too much on these low-level, like, protest-related offenses, like failure to disperse. But that's definitely something that can happen while charges are open. People are unable to find work. And so hopefully courts are able to find a way to deal with some of that backlog. I think district courts, at least here, are starting to do more proceedings. But we'll see what happens. And hopefully your cases are all resolved in dismissals, I hope.
Yeah, that's the fingers crossed, right?
Yeah. All right, Allie, thanks for talking to us a little bit about bankruptcy laws and how they might affect people in Kentucky. So we're going to go ahead and move on to our 2 usual topics, our COVID-19 update and what's going on in the Breonna Taylor investigation and with the protests. So Starting with COVID, with the exception of the typical low Sunday and Monday numbers that we have every week, daily cases have been steadily in the 800s since we talked last week. And while cases have steadily increased, our positivity rate has been down for a couple weeks, which means that more testing is being done, which is a good thing. It ticked up a little bit today to 4.7% from, you know, we'd seen around like 4.4, but it's still been under 5% for over a week now, and we were trending like high, like 5.8% a few weeks ago. So it is good that our positivity rate is down, but our daily case numbers and deaths have been kind of on a slow increase over the last few weeks. The other big news is that the governor's office announced new childcare regulations. So some of them include class sizes may now increase from 10 to 15, tours can resume, and parents are allowed to visit their children at childcare centers again. Temporary childcare centers may still operate, but will still need to meet state licensing requirements within 90 days. So I think the government allowed for these temporary childcare centers to operate without licenses for healthcare workers and essential workers. So now they can still do that, but they have to meet the licensing requirements within the next 90 days. Small in-home childcare centers will be able to receive a $2,500 stipend to become licensed. And so these new regulations are meant to ease the burden for childcare facilities. One third of the childcare centers have not reopened since they had to close in March. So hopefully these things will allow some to reopen while still, you know, keeping kids safe, because cases have been up in children. So hopefully they're able to still do that with these new regulations. Allie, you have a toddler.
Yep, and I sure do.
So you don't have to use daycare, right? You've got some family daycare. But, you know, if you did, I think it would be a really tough decision to make whether you want to send your child to a daycare right now or find some other kind of childcare for them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm lucky that my mom is retired and she moved here for the purpose of taking care of grandbabies. That was her jam. But I have a lot of friends who are making that tough decision right now, and a lot of friends who have been, you know, working from home with their, you know, kids with them, which is like just crazy.
Yeah, I can hardly like work at home and it's just me, so I can't imagine having to do it with children also. Yeah. But so hopefully some of the ones that have been closed will be able to reopen, and hopefully we can still keep kids safe.
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, it's also Derby Week, and Governor Beshear urged people to take precautions for Derby weekend and to stay safe and not have huge parties. He said that he will not be presenting the trophy because he will stay at home and watch it on TV. I do appreciate that he's like really practicing what he preaches. He posts pictures on Twitter of them like getting Thai food takeout and stuff. So I believe him when he says he's going to stay at home and be safe. So I picked Tiz the Law for my Derby horse, but then his trainer said something really racist. So now I'm on the lookout for a new Derby horse if anyone has any suggestions on who it should bet on.
I'll have to send you. So my husband usually does some statistics and analytics on the Derby horses, and he works at Doe Anderson, and they do a projection of what horses are most likely to win. It usually picks up some media attention.
Yeah,
so I'll send you that. Yeah.
Yeah, so Allie and I are also connected because her husband is a data analyst, and so is Robert, my co-host, and Allie's from Robert's wife's hometown. So we just know each other from a lot of different things.
Robert and Nick are both data nerds.
Yeah. All right, so that's kind of it for our COVID update. Beshear was talking as we started recording and said he had some new announcements about development projects. So that might have to be something we touch on next week. So we're going to move on to our Breonna Taylor case update. And a lot's happened since last week. So first, Daniel Cameron announced that his office has received ballistics testing and is meeting with the FBI to review reports. And he said that no announcement would be made this week. And I think the reason that he keeps making these statements now are because for a while, there seemed to be rumors every single week that an announcement was going to be made and that it was going to be that there weren't going to be charges. And so everyone was tense every time these rumors would come out every week. I think sometimes Sean King was starting them. I feel like every week for about a month there, people were saying it's going to happen today and people were boarding up the courthouse. So I think now Daniel Cameron is just telling people, I'm not telling you this week. And so that's what he's done again this week. He also went on a news program called Face the Nation and said that he condones violence in all forms. And I think he meant condemn there. I think some people were giving him some crap about that, but I think he meant to say condemn. And, you know, I have a lot to say to Daniel Cameron most of the time, but I think that was just a slip of the tongue. So here's kind of the big story of this last week. Around the time that we recorded, the Courier-Journal released, took down, and then re-released a piece about an internal LMPD report containing jail phone call records between Jamarcus Glover and Breonna Taylor, as well as calls from Jamarcus Glover to other people where he mentions Breonna. And Jamarcus Glover is her ex-boyfriend. The LMPD report is undated, but it definitely seems to be trying to connect dots and, you know, dig up alleged dirt after her death, because it contains calls that took place after her death. So none of that information could have been used as evidence to obtain the warrant. You know, to me, what may be the only thing that's clear from the calls is that Breonna and Mr. Glover still had a connection early in 2020. The report also attempts to connect her to drug-related activity through the calls, where he tells someone else that Bree handled his money, which could literally mean nothing and anything, I think. And, you know, the Courier-Journal even noted that there was nothing else to substantiate that or corroborate it, and no money was found at her home. There were also calls after her death where Jamarcus Glover told someone that he didn't understand why they searched her house, because the only tie he had was that she had posted bonds for him in the past. You know, these kind of reports are something that have been like typical from police in cases like Freddie Gray, where they tried to talk about his criminal record and being seen with a knife on the day of his death, and also Trayvon Martin. And now in Jacob Blake's case as well. And so, you know, they're just internal reports that seem to be done after the fact as some kind of justification.
Exactly. It seems like a ploy to, you know, sway the court of public opinion.
Yeah.
And a smear campaign, honestly, against her.
Yeah, absolutely. Shortly after the article about the LMPD report, Philip Bailey, Darcy Costello, and Tessa Duvall of the Courier-Journal and USA Today published an article with an interview from Jamarcus Glover. So after missing court, Glover had a bench warrant, and he gave this interview shortly before being arrested on the warrant. In this interview, he said that there had never been anything illegal at Breonna's house or sent to her house. He talked about having clothes and shoes sent to her house sometimes. And, you know, I think it's common to, if he had lived there before, you have things sent to old addresses. I've done it before. And sometimes if people are more transient or move around a lot, they have packages sent to a certain place. And he said that nothing illegal had ever been sent there. He also commented on the allegation that warrants were executed in the area because of a real estate development project. That's something that's been alleged by Breonna Taylor's family's attorney in their civil lawsuit, that this was part kind of a gentrification project of the Russell neighborhood. And he said that a detective actually told him that they would get off his back if he moved out. So he kind of gives some credibility to that claim. Then on Monday, WDRB's Jason Riley released a story regarding a plea deal that was offered to Breonna Taylor's ex-boyfriend, Mr. Glover. The facts in the plea sheets would require him to admit that over a period of time through April 22nd, he and several co-defendants, including Breonna Taylor, engaged in organized crime by trafficking large amounts of drugs into the Louisville community. So the deal would be for a 10-year sentence where he would be able to ask for probation. So, you know, if he was charged with multiple indictments with lots of offenses, especially engaging in organized crime, because that's a Class B felony, 10 years and the possibility of probation is a pretty good deal, actually.
It's huge. Yeah.
Sam Aguiar, the Taylor family's attorney, said that the plea shows the lengths to which those within the police department and the Commonwealth's attorney went to after Breonna Taylor's killing to try and paint a picture of her which was vastly different than the woman she truly was. And, you know, that does seem to be what this is, because I don't know why on earth you would need to plead to facts implicating a co-defendant that's now deceased, because they're not getting any kind of testimony out of that to prosecute her.
Yeah. And wasn't she, was never previously named as a co-defendant.
No, so she wasn't.
To name someone in an indictment who's not actually a listed co-defendant and never has been.
Is weird.
Is really strange. Yeah.
Yeah. After this article came out, the Jefferson County Commonwealth's attorney, Tom Wine, said that the plea sheets were only a draft and part of the negotiations, and that when he learned of the negotiations, he asked that her name be taken out of respect. He also said that the offer was withdrawn after Mr. Glover failed to show up to court and was rearrested. So these were plea sheets that were drafted and probably sent to his attorney back in July, and then he missed court and was rearrested and arraigned on his bench warrant and apparently no longer has that offer. And, you know, I think the only thing to gain from adding this language of a deceased, unindicted person is just, like you said, with the internal LMPD report, it's just a justification for the police in the court of public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think it's some justification in the civil lawsuit,
yeah,
where LMPD is a defendant. So
that's a good point.
I think that is why they would want that language in the plea sheets. But that plea seems to be no longer on the table anyways. Shortly after, you know, the plea negotiations were released, Mr. Glover gave a second interview from Louisville Metro Department of Corrections, and he said that he actually turned down the offer after seeing the names of people he would be implicating and said they're incriminating other people who had nothing to do with anything. You know, I think he's charged with several felony offenses, and to be giving interviews, I think, is a big risk for him. So,
huge,
you know,
yeah,
it seems that he, like, truly cares about clearing her name. He's out here giving interviews from undisclosed locations and from the jail. And that's a big risk, because anything that he says can be used against him at
Scott
trial.
Scott Barton is his attorney?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I would imagine that's something that Scott may have advised against. I don't know, maybe not, but that's pretty typical as, you know, something you would say, let's not do that.
Right, exactly. In other Breonna Taylor and protest-related news, her boyfriend at the time of her death, Kenneth Walker, he has filed a civil lawsuit against the state, Metro Louisville, Daniel Cameron, Tom Wine, and Mayor Fisher, among other defendants as well. So he's seeking damages for assault and battery, false arrest and imprisonment, malicious prosecution, and negligence. And he's also seeking a finding that he's protected from prosecution under Kentucky Stand Your Ground laws. So we know from the past few months that the Commonwealth Attorney's Office did dismiss his attempted murder charges for firing a shot at the officers, but those charges were dismissed without prejudice, which means that they can be brought back and they're still investigating whether to bring charges against him. So this civil lawsuit is seeking damages for all those things I just named, but it's also seeking a ruling from the judge that he can't be recharged. He's going to be represented in his civil suit by Fred Moore and Steve Romans. Steve Romans also represents the family of David McAtee, and Fred Moore is a former public defender, and Steve Romans is also a well-known criminal defense attorney as well, but they'll be representing him in this civil lawsuit. There's also a New York Times piece about Breonna Taylor and an FX and Hulu special that was announced this week. So, you know, we'll link the New York Times piece, but I try to cover local journalism because the Courier-Journal has had super thorough coverage on the investigation, and they also have their own newsletter where you can get up-to-date information about it as well. Just the last few protest-related notes, I think that we can expect Derby Day protests from Until Freedom, the national group that's kind of been stationed in Louisville over the last month or so, and potentially the Not Effing Around Coalition said that they would come back at Derby time if no decision had been made. The UK football team also walked out of practice last week in protest, and the UK basketball team released a Black Lives Matter video. So as a UK fan, I'm super proud of my teams for doing that. It's certainly not popular in Kentucky, and a lot of their fans probably disagree. I saw someone on Twitter burned their UK shirts, but I'm really proud of my teams.
Yeah, me too.
Then lastly, Senate Republicans Julie Rocky Adams, Damon Thayer, Senate President Stivers, David Givens, and Mike Wilson have penned a letter to Bashir asking him to intervene with violence and protests in Louisville. They also held a press conference and suggested a special session, as well as calling in the National Guard. The National Guard was called in back in May, and the National Guard is who killed David McAtee. And so we see how well that went the last time the National Guard was here. I think this is, you know, Julie Rocky Adams is from Louisville, but this is just another example of, like, the legislature's anti-Louisville sentiments, I think. We've talked about all those War on Louisville bills a few years ago, the JCPS takeover, and now they're asking for additional intervention and saying that Mayor Fisher hasn't handled this well. I'm not saying that Mayor Fisher has handled it the best, but I also don't think that we need the National Guard here. You know, we need to pass legislation like Breonna's Law, but I also worry that the Republican supermajority legislature would not be passing bills like that in a special session. All right, that is all we have for today. Thank you for listening. And first, I want Allie to plug her business before I talk about my Old Kentucky podcast. So, Allie, if people are struggling financially right now and need to talk about bankruptcy options, or they just have questions about what some of their financial options might be, how can they reach you?
Sure. So if you're having any financial issues you want to discuss, even if maybe, you know, you're not sure bankruptcy is something you want to do yet, we offer free consultations. And right now you can do that over the phone or through video chat from the comfort of your own home. You can call us at 502-964-7878. That's Wasson and Thornhill.
Thanks, Allie. And you can find my Old Kentucky podcast on Twitter and Instagram at my old KY pod. You can like our Facebook page and listen to our podcast on the podcast app of your choice. We also have a Patreon page where you can support what we're doing for as little as $1 a month. You can do that at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast. We also have a newsletter that comes out on Fridays. We partner with Ford Kentucky to do that, and you can subscribe to it and Ford Kentucky's newsletters at fordky.com/email. And last but not least, we are part of the Demcast Network. Thanks for listening. The young folks roll on the little cabin floor, all merry.